Well, thanks for the invitation. I guess I'm your break from von Neumann algebras this morning. So what I'll be talking about today is, well, a series of Gedanken experiments. These Gedanken experiments were first investigated by Bob Wald and Dane Danielson, who's also in the audience. And then I'll tell you about some recent work with also Jonah Kudler-Flam, who's also in the audience. I should say that in this short talk, I won't be able to get through all of the content of these papers. I hope to give you a flavor of what's going on here, but Dane is gonna give an excellent poster later that will go into the full details. Okay, so this is a series of Gedanken experiments. I mean, I'm mentioning horizons at the upfront here, but actually this Gedanken experiment really started with just trying to understand a Gedanken experiment in flat space-time. So let me go over that Gedanken experiment in detail because it's gonna be the basis for the rest of this talk. And in particular, let's do the electromagnetic case. There's also a gravitational version, but the electromagnetic case is first simpler to think about. And as always, we're gonna have an experimenter, Alice, who has a charged particle. And she's gonna make a spatial superposition of a charged particle in her lab. Well, maybe it's easier to see a diagram or space-time diagram. What I'm imagining here is, you know, she starts her PhD way, way in the past, and she has a charged particle with some spin. And she's gonna pass that charged particle through a Stern-Gerlach apparatus. If it initially had spin in the x direction, she's gonna make a spatial superposition in her lab of up and down in the z direction. And her PhD is to just maintain that superposition for the duration of her PhD. So I guess this is around 5 years, and I'm imagining some futuristic PhD student who, she deserves a Nobel Prize at this stage already. But she's not gonna graduate yet. She needs to flip her Stern-Gerlach apparatus upside down, pass her beams of her particle back through the apparatus, recombine the particle, and she graduates if she has maintained coherence. Okay, so this is extremely hard, and why is she even worried about this? Well, there's another experimentalist, Bob, and Bob does not want Alice to graduate. In particular, Bob is extremely clever. He's gonna try to not get caught in any way, and he has a particle initially in a trap. So the idea here is that he's gonna cleverly wait and keep this particle in a trap so it's initially uncorrelated with Alice's superposition. And right at that predetermined time, let's say her committee meeting or something, he's going to open the trap and release this particle. Okay, why is Bob so clever? Well, this particle is going to feel the long-range Coulomb field of Alice's particle having either gone to the right or gone to the left, and his particle is now going to become correlated with the different positions of Alice's particle. Okay, so I can see some concerned faces in the audience, and why would you be concerned? Well, if Bob's particle can obtain which path information on Alice's particle and thereby become correlated with Alice's particle, that means that Bob's particle is entangled with Alice's particle. And you might use the word complementarity to describe the statement that therefore Alice's particle is thereby entangled with Bob's particle. And consequently, Alice's particle must be decohered to some degree. However, and the reason why some of you might be upset is because by causality, Bob's particle should not be able to influence the coherence of Alice's particle at all. Okay, so I'm describing QED, so obviously it is a completely causal theory, but exactly how it's causal is the main subject of this talk. And in particular, I have ignored some degrees of freedom that are essential to understand what's going on here. In particular, Alice's experiment, what does she have to do? She needs to recombine her particle back together within a light travel time from Bob, and may decohere herself by the emission of entangling radiation, irrespective of Bob's measurement. In particular, Bob is trying to make a very sensitive measurement of the distinct electromagnetic fields in his region, and is fundamentally always limited by vacuum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field. So let's take these two into account on the next slide and see how far we can get. So in particular, this first bullet point is just analyzing the decoherence of Alice's particle alone. And if we want to analyze that, well, we need to look at the radiation states of Alice's particle having gone on the right, or the radiation state of Alice's particle having gone on the left, that's what psi 1 and psi 2 are. And the decoherence is simply determined by the orthogonality of these two radiation states of Alice's particle. Okay? And it's really simple to calculate that, and you can derive a very simple formula. It's related to the expected number of what we call these so-called entangling photons. Precisely what that means is that if you take the difference of these two radiation states, psi 1 and psi 2, and compute the expected number of photons, that those are the photons that know the difference between the radiation state going along path 1 or path 2. Well, that, if she emits an order 1 number of these entangling photons, then she will be completely decohered. But hopefully it's intuitively clear that if she recombines slow enough, she can avoid emitting any of this entangling radiation and avoid decohering herself. And in particular, she needs to recombine precisely this slowly. Okay, so what's Bob's limitation? Well, Bob's particle is coupled to the electromagnetic field. The vacuum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field gave a fundamental noise to Bob's measurement, determined by the charge radius of his body. And so therefore, Bob is trying to make this displacement measurement and must integrate his particle displacement bigger than this fundamental noise that he's going to fundamentally have on his detector. And he has to integrate this experiment within a light travel time from Alice. So that's the fundamental limitation on Bob. And the basic point, well, what was estimated at the back of the envelope here and then rigorously proven for any measurement, not just this particle displacement measurement that I've highlighted here, rigorously proven in this paper with Dane and Bob, is that both Alice and Bob cannot succeed simultaneously in their measurements. How should you think about that? Well, let's consider the case where I enlarge this diamond here, and I allow Alice to recombine arbitrarily slowly. Well, you can imagine, as I enlarge this diamond, I'm shrinking the duration over which Bob can integrate his experiment beyond a vacuum fluctuation. And therefore, he cannot succeed in this experiment, is what we rigorously show. However, if we let Bob integrate his experiment beyond a vacuum fluctuation, I allow this region to be as big as Bob needs it to be, that shrinks the duration over which Alice can make her experiment, and you can rigorously prove that she must decohere herself by the emission of entangling radiation. Okay, so what's the general lesson that will carry us over to the case of the horizons that we do prove is that Alice must always decohere herself, in particular, by the emission of entangling radiation, at least as much as any Bobs could decohere her at space-like separation. And in particular, if Alice recombines sufficiently adiabatically in flat space-time, then she can maintain coherence, and as I said before, all the Bobs are pushed out at space-like separation. Okay, but that's not the subject of my talk. What I want to talk about are horizons and black holes, and which sounds like a crazy thing to consider, but for this slide, just please humor me in considering such a thing. So now suppose a black hole is present, and these Bob or multiple Bobs, or I should have said, this resolution here was for any number of Bobs making joint measurements at space-like separation. So now let's consider that, allow any number of Bobs. These Bobs are not Bob-walled, so they're expendable. We're just gonna throw them into the black hole, and we're gonna let them make arbitrary measurements in the interior of the black hole. And the only difference now is that Alice is in the exterior, so she's not time limited. We're gonna allow her to make an arbitrarily adiabatic experiment, and she can recombine as slowly as she likes. So this is the diagram I have in my head. If it's unfamiliar to you, all you need to know is that this is the horizon, and this is scry. These are the regions that are gonna be the most important, and I've depicted basically what I've been saying is an optimal experiment for Alice. What is optimal? She wants to avoid emitting any radiation to infinity. So we don't want her lab falling into the black hole. That's not following the stationary killing field. And neither is she doesn't want the particles falling into the black hole. So she needs to make sure everything follows as closely as possible to the stationary killing field in the exterior of the black hole. That will minimize any radiation to scry. Okay? And this time duration T is the duration she's just going to do her PhD in, now in the exterior of a black hole. So, you know, maybe farther in the future than we might expect. Okay, so what's now I hope is clear is that the Bobs cannot causally influence Alice, but if the superposition in the exterior is maintained for a long time, they should be able to accumulate arbitrarily good which path information. So that's what I've depicted here. The Bobs can measure the long-range Coulomb field emanating from Alice's particle gone to the left and right, and I'm going to restrict them to doing measurements in the interior of the black hole. Okay, so what's the resolution? Well, if the lesson I told you on the previous slide was any indication, it's that indeed black holes in this context will harvest which path information of quantum superpositions held in their exterior. And in particular, what we'll now just calculate is that the presence of a black hole will force Alice's particle to radiate, emit entangling soft photons and gravitons fully into the black hole. Nothing goes out to scry. And result in a constant rate of decoherence. And so this is actually the this is how we're going to do the calculation. All the adiabatic process is ensuring that we have no radiation out to scry. But what must be the case for the causal consistency of the theory is that these radiation states is non-negligible on the horizon. And in particular, what we'll calculate is the decoherence due to the presence of the black hole cannot be zero. And also, it must grow in the time that I maintain the superposition in the exterior. Okay? All of the steps in this short talk, I won't be able to talk about the general story for an arbitrary killing horizon, but every step of this analysis follows for any stationary superposition held in the exterior of any killing horizon. And the presence of any such horizon will completely decohere any superposition in their vicinity. Okay. So now we're just going to do a calculation. So what's the calculation? I need to invent some coordinates. So it's very useful to write down this affine time v, which is the affine time on the horizon of the black hole. That's related to the more conventional killing time, which you may be more used to, which is roughly the proper time in Alice's lab. That's because Alice's lab is following the stationary trajectories outside the black hole, and they're related by this exponential factor. This r coordinate is the proper distance off the horizon of the black hole, and these angular coordinates here are just correspond to the cross sections of the black hole, which are spheres. Okay, so now forget quantum mechanics for a second. I just want to consider a single charged particle first and the radiation field from one branch of Alice's superposition. So let's consider such a particle. Let's consider a charged particle initially located at some distance r equals d from the horizon of the black hole. So this is initially a stationary particle, and I'm going to slowly displace it by an amount little d in the exterior of the black hole. So pictorially, this is what I'm doing. I have this particle here, and I'm going to slowly displace it to a new position. Okay, and the game here is to just analyze what is the radiation field produced by this process. Well, if I do this displacement arbitrarily adiabatically, then no radiation will propagate out to infinity. So what's really relevant is what is the radiation as registered on the horizon of the black hole. Well, that sounds like a very complicated analysis. I have to do some, motion of some body in a curved space-time. However, it's extremely simple to analyze if you pull back Maxwell's equations to the horizon of a black hole. And Maxwell's equations take this extremely simple form, which relates the Coulomb field, the radial component of the electric field, corresponds to the Coulomb field as registered on the horizon from the charged body in the exterior. Okay? And it relates the change in this Coulomb field to the horizon radiation. Why is this the horizon radiation? Well, if the radiation is propagating in radially, that means it oscillates transversely, which in these coordinates are angularly. Okay, so the derivative here is the derivative on the sphere, and this formula exactly is what I want to consider. I'm moving a body in the exterior, thereby changing the Coulomb field as registered on the horizon, and that will result in the production of some horizon radiation. Okay, so this is the formula. Now let's analyze it. Well, for a static test charge, if I just keep a charge in the exterior of the black hole, well, you can check, explicitly, that the horizon radiation vanishes. That's the statement that holding a charged body in the exterior of a black hole doesn't radiate either to infinity or into the horizon. And the radial component is exact, the magnitude is exactly what you expect. It's given by the charge over the distance from the horizon squared. Okay, and now I want to move this body in the exterior. And throughout this process, the horizon radiation is extremely small. I'm moving this body adiabatically in the exterior of the black hole. And so, however, you cannot approximate it to be zero. Why is that? Well, if the change in the Coulomb field as registered on this horizon is non-zero, right? The horizon's a finite place. If I take this body and I displace it to a new position, I get a new value of the Coulomb field on the horizon. And if I integrate this equation, what that means is that the total integral of the electric field as the horizon radiation as registered on the horizon is not zero. Okay? So I can't approximate it to be zero, but that's not the claim I was making. Let's continue on, though. Well, let's rewrite this electric field in terms of the vector potential on the horizon, which is what we'll ultimately quantize. So in terms of the vector potential, the electric field is the time derivative of the vector potential, which implies that this formula implies that the vector potential as registered on the horizon must suffer a permanent change between early and late times. So if you're lost at this point, just stare at this picture. So I'm claiming the vector potential for any charged body that you just move in the exterior of the black hole, the vector potential as registered on the horizon has this behavior, where this permanent change in the vector potential is proportional to the change in the Coulomb field as registered on the horizon. Okay, so as I mentioned, well, we're now going to quantize this and ask what is the number of photons created from moving the body in this exterior in this way. Well, I gave you a classical vector potential, so the quantum state associated to that is a coherent state. And the expected number of photons produced in the coherent state, one can just, it's extremely easy to calculate, and I'm just giving you the answer, is given by the norm of this classical solution. The norm here in this on the horizon. So the norm here is, I mean, this may look a little funny if you haven't seen it before, but it's the Fourier transform of the vector potential on the horizon with respect to affine time. There's an integral over positive frequencies and an integral over all angles. Okay? So if you haven't seen this before, this is a formula that lets me compute the expected number of photons for this particular process that I'm considering. Okay? Okay, so this is extremely easy to calculate in this particular case. The change in the vector potential between early and late times is non-zero. Its Fourier transform at low frequencies, therefore, must diverge like the Fourier transform of a step function, which goes like 1 over omega. And therefore, the expected number of photons produced in this process is logarithmically divergent at low frequencies. For those of you who attended my talk last week, this should look extremely familiar. This is a manifestation of the memory effect, but on the black hole or generally killing horizons. Okay, so if you didn't attend a talk, that's not a prerequisite for this talk, so don't worry. So what is the basic point? Displacing a charged body in the exterior of a black hole and keeping it there forever results in the emission of an infinite number of soft horizon photons, all propagating into the black hole, none of them to scry. Okay? So I'm not interested in taking a body and displacing it forever. I want to bring it back. I want to do an interference experiment in the end. So if I displace it back after some proper time t in my lab, then the expected number of photons produced is finite, but possibly large for large t. Okay, and so you can explicitly calculate this. The expected number of photons is going to be logarithmically divergent in the affine time that I've perturbed the body in the exterior, but that means it's linearly divergent in the proper time in Alice's lab. Okay, so now I hope you can see that, well, I did this for one branch of Alice's superposition. Now we just have to do it for both branches, and the expected number of photons will again linearly grow in the photons flux to infinity to the horizon will linearly grow in the proper time in Alice's lab. And the decoherence is given by exactly the formula I gave you before, where now this expected number of photons is the number of entangling photons propagating through the horizon. And after an order one number of such entangling photons propagating through the horizon, the Alice's superposition in the exterior will be completely decohered. Okay, so you can calculate this, and this gives you an intrinsic rate or a time scale in which any superposition held in the exterior of a black hole is decohered. For the electromagnetic case, for a charge superposed over a distance d, here's the particular time scale. For a massive body, you can repeat everything I just said, but now for the propagation of soft gravitons through the black hole, and you get an intrinsic time scale for decoherence. Note this very strong dependence in the distance from the horizon, which is why current laboratory experiments don't need to worry about this effect. However, if you had an electron superposed over a meter, and you're about 6m away from the black hole, this decoherence time would be about 5 minutes. So Alice's PhD would have to be kind of quick. Okay, so the other statement that I don't have time to talk about in this talk is that this is actually it's very important that you have this extremely large blue shift on the horizon for this effect. And if you perform this experiment sufficiently adiabatically outside the gravitational field of just an ordinary massive body, so I'm not including the internal degrees of freedom, which would give rise to ordinary decoherence, but just the gravitational field of an ordinary massive body would not decohere Alice's particle in this manner. Okay, and so how much time do I have? Oh, good. Okay, so the last thing I want to mention is, well, I mentioned the bobs inside the black hole were extremely helpful, at least in gaining intuition as to why this effect should exist. But how precise is that statement? So what about the decoherence due to bobs in the interior of the black hole? Well, if we consider any bounded region in the interior of the black hole, we can consider the two quantum states that Bob would try to distinguish in the interior, psi1 and psi2, which corresponds to the electromagnetic states of Alice's particle either going right or going left. In the interior of the black hole. So let's consider this particular case. So what is this bounded region here? This is the interior where I'm allowing Bob to make arbitrary measurements trying to distinguish the two quantum states in the interior of the black hole, psi1 and psi2. And again, Alice is doing her experiment in the exterior. Okay, and so this decoherence due to Bob, well, you now need to precisely characterize what you mean by trying to distinguish two quantum states in some bounded region of the spacetime. And one can characterize this by the so-called fidelity, or the Haleva fidelity, which in this particular case is, I don't have time to go through the full definition for you today, but it's roughly speaking the error in Bob's optimal measurement in distinguishing the possible states psi1 and psi2 in some bounded region in the interior of the black hole. For the purposes of this talk, it eats two quantum states, local quantum states, of the electromagnetic field psi1 and psi2, and spits out a number between 0 and 1. 0 meaning that this Bob can perfectly distinguish, there exists a measurement in this local region in which Bob can perfectly distinguish the states. 1 meaning there exists no local measurement in that region in which Bob can distinguish the states. Okay, but in quantum mechanics, just to give you another way of intuitively understanding this, in quantum mechanics, the fidelity is just, you know, I have these states here can be represented as density matrices, and the fidelity is just given by the trace of the density matrices in this manner. But in quantum field theory, as was mentioned by a series of talks prior to mine, these local density matrices don't exist, and one really needs to use modular theory to define these quantities correctly. Let me not try to do that in this short talk, but let me tell you some basic punchlines. So one statement is that, well, it is known that the fidelity is a monotonic function as I increase the region over which Bob can make measurements. However, one can prove much stronger statements. For example, this fidelity is not just monotonic, but strictly decreasing as a function of time. What does that mean? As I increase this region, you know, allowing Bob to make better and better optimal measurements in the interior of the black hole, this fidelity is strictly decreasing, which means that they can better and better distinguish Alice's superposition in the exterior. So not only is it a strictly decreasing function of time, it is exactly bounded by the expected number of these soft gravitons that Alice has emitted, or photons, into the black hole. And in particular, perhaps one of the more interesting statements is that if you take the t goes to infinity, so I allow Bob to make arbitrary joint measurements in the interior of the black, in the full interior of the black hole, then you recover exactly Alice's decoherence in the exterior. So in particular, the decoherence due to the black hole or any horizon is equivalent to the decoherence due to the optimal which path information measurement made in their interior, the full interior of the black hole. Okay, and so let me end with one more comment or statement. So this growth of quantum information as we're seeing in the interior of the black hole that the Bobs are getting better and better access to, implies a relationship between this quantity that the Bobs that characterizes the distinguishability that Bob can access in the interior of the black hole and the accrued decoherence of Alice's particle in the exterior just from holding the superposition. So this is in a paper that will come out shortly. Alice's experiment, in order to make contact between this definition I gave you before and the accrued decoherence of Alice's particle, it's much more useful to rephrase Alice's experiment as opposed to this particular one that I mentioned, but as a quantum channel. So what does that mean? It just means that it's mapping initially her initial pure state to a possible mixed state during this particular experiment. And we can ask what's happening, if I start with her initial state and then I hold it in the exterior of a black hole, I could stop it at some time t and say, and this characterizes the state of her particle at that time. That's what this quantum channel is describing. And so how would you characterize decoherence in this context? You would characterize it particularly in this way. If you wanted to characterize the decoherence, you could ask, well, how reversible in her lab is the experiment that she's just applying? So in particular, you could ask, does there exist a decoding channel, a basically map that reverses the local experiment done in her lab? And you could ask, one in particular decoding channel might not be sufficient, but if you take the infimum over all such possible channels that she can do in her lab, you can characterize the amount of decoherence that she's accrued during the duration of the experiment at that time t. And if you take this time t to be the full time duration of her experiment after she's fully recombined, you can show that this notion of decoherence, which is now valid at all times during the duration of the experiment, it gives me the decoherence I gave you at the end of the experiment. Okay, so why is this useful at all? Well, it turns out everything I've just described today is a consequence of a single inequality, which is this information disturbance trade-off, which relates the fidelity as measured over this interior region of the black hole to this generalized notion of decoherence as I've described for you here. And in particular, I don't have time fully to go through the full consequences of this statement, but you should see that exactly all of the intuition I was trying to build throughout this talk, which is that Alice must always decohere herself at least as much as the Bobs at space-like separation, is actually all encapsulated in this one inequality. In particular, you can take the limits where this fidelity goes from 0 to 1 and recover every single statement that I've made throughout this talk. Okay, so with that, let me just end with this more general, with this list of summaries that I've given that refer to this talk, and let me just state that I believe that the fact that black holes and cosmological horizons will eventually decohere any quantum superposition in their exterior, and that decoherence can be exactly related to measurements made in their interior, may be of fundamental significance to our understanding of the nature of such structures in the fundamental theory. So let me take questions.
Thank you very much. Quite time for questions. I see John up there, and then other John.
So you said something that was quite surprising to me earlier in your talk, and I think it's related to bullet point 3 on this slide, which is you claimed that if you hold a charged particle at a fixed Schwarzschild radius, you don't get any radiation across the horizon.
Yeah.
But I would have thought there's like some local, locally you're accelerating, there's some Bremsstrahlung effect. Can you explain
why
that doesn't work?
Yeah, this is a very old confusion. So first of all, you can just explicitly calculate a charged particle in the exterior of a black hole. So you could wonder why it's consistent with the equivalence principle. It's basically the statement that, well, you can solve for the local electric field in the interior of the lab, but what I'm saying is I'm holding a charged particle for some duration of time. The equivalence principle is a statement about locality in space and time, and the radiation is a non-local concept, right? Because you want to say, what's propagating out into the horizon or to scry? So there's no conflict with what the values of the local electric field are, but that's not a statement that the actual charged particle is radiating. That's a non-local statement.
Good, John, then there's a question back there.
So if Alice wants to do her electromagnetic version of the interference experiment, does it work for her to build a Faraday cage around the black hole?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she could build a, well, let me...
Let's tell her to do that.
Yeah, if she reflects the photons sufficiently, I mean, they would have to reflect these sufficiently long wavelength photons, but I don't see anything in principle wrong.
But that's not going to help her with
the gravitational case. Not in the gravitational case, certainly not, no.
I'm confused about a number of things when you make the black hole extremal. This is also related to the issue about you've ignored the Hawking radiation.
Could you speak up? Go ahead.
Yeah, so could you explain what happens in the extremal black hole case? And also what the effect is, connected question is, what is the effect of the Hawking radiation which occurs in the non-extremal case? Because you're limited further, right, in your ability
to measure. I'm working out the extremal case. I think in the exactly zero temperature limit, this effect does not go, there is no effect of this sort. I don't have an intuitive explanation for you at the moment, though.
I would expect that this effect goes to zero in the extremal black hole case.
Yes, that's right. It does go to zero in the extremal black hole case. But, that's right.
All right, one more question. Jonathan.
Can you explain what changes if I just replace the horizon of the black hole, which is a perfect absorber? It absorbs both electromagnetic radiation and gravity.
Oh, so like some time-like surface that just has absorbed. Yeah, so like, you know, some conductor. Could I? Okay. So in that case, you can explicitly solve this case. An absorber. So what's important is that the whatever absorber you have can absorb these extremely low frequency photons, which are really generated on the horizon of the black hole, and so you would have to look at the constraints of Maxwell's equations on this perfect absorber and whether or not. I mean, so what's happening in this case is that the Coulomb field, when it registers on the black hole horizon, as I fluctuate the Coulomb field in the exterior, is pumping this soft radiation into the interior of the black hole. Like, you could even wonder, this is partially answering your question, so let me know if it doesn't. You could even wonder, if I just shone some light on the black hole, it would not absorb these extremely low frequency photons. What's relevant is this constraint from Maxwell's equations that in which the Coulomb field, which doesn't see the angular momentum barrier between the black hole and the charged particle, it goes and penetrates through the angular momentum barrier and hits the horizon. Using the fact that the Coulomb field can do that, can penetrate through the angular momentum barrier, you can therefore pump in these low frequency photons. So I think you would need a mechanism of this sort. I'm not sure. You would need to analyze that particular case with the constraints from Maxwell's equations that you get on that time-like surface in a similar way.
Okay, great. Let's thank the speaker and all our speakers again for a great session.